Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to All About Guitar with Jeff Lolo, only on LA Talk Radio.
Amazing instrument. It has developed into an incredible voice in today's music. So many types of guitars, so many styles of playing, all sorts of gear. How does one make their voice be heard as a guitarist? My name is Jeff Floro and welcome to All About Guitar, where we talk tone, we talk technique, we talk gear. Where we discover how we can become better musicians in a world of constantly changing technologies. Where we take a good look at everything guitar. And sometimes not exactly guitar, but just as important. So we can be more successful as a musician in today's music scene. So sit back and relax, and let's explore All About Guitar. Good evening, everybody. Welcome to All About Guitar. We have a great show for you tonight. This is one of my favorite types of shows because we get really into the history of guitar and a major innovator of the instrument. Tonight we're going to talk about Orville Gibson. And I have a full house in here. And first of all, I want to thank Gary Rudenko from the Amp Shop Bass Exchange for introducing me to Greg and Sharon DeLorda, who are here. They also work at Heritage Guitars, which is the original luthiers of the Gibson guitars that over in Kalamazoo, Michigan. And also, too, I have my friends Doug and Rosalind Moore. And Rosalind brought in a 1952 LG1. It's a beautiful guitar. And also, too, I have two other people, Edwin Stepp and Trevor Jolly, who are, I'm going to have Sharon talk about it. They're working on a documentary on Orville and I forget the address for
225 Parsons Street.
225 Parsons, because it's the whole story about the Kalamazoo plant and the history behind it. And then also, too, on Skype from up north, from Union Grove Music, Richard Gellis, who is kind of an expert on pre-World War II instruments, and he also is a dealer for Vintage Guitar Magazine, and just a person we're going to pick his brains about with all the history and stuff. So I want to welcome everybody here. It's an honor to have you guys here. And this is, I'm just anxious to dig right in. So we'll start with Sharon. Give us a little bit of a background on, you were going to talk a little bit about Orville's life, and we'll just go from there.
Okay. Well, first, I guess I should say how I started to become interested in Orville. I knew nothing about him. I was a retired paralegal, but I was married to Greg. We'd been married for about 3 years, 2 years, and I tried to write his history. I had a stumbling block because I had to learn about 225 Parsons Street. Well, you can't learn about 225 Parsons Street without learning about Orville Gibson. So therein went my journey. I knew nothing about him, and I discovered a wonderful person who has really come to life in our home. He really is a family member now. He was born in 1856 in Malone, New York. He died in 1918 in New York. He was a Kalamazoo luthier for many years. He started out there in 1873, and he was not originally a luthier. The term back at that time was probably just starting. But he was very much into the local entertainment. He sang, he danced, he played multiple instruments, and so he performed constantly in the local theater. He not was just an entertainer, but he also produced and promoted others. One of the instruments that he promoted a lot was the banjo. That was a surprise to me, because seeing and realizing that he started out with a mandolin, and that's where he got his patent, and Richard Gellis will speak more about that. But I was really surprised to discover his journey. And I think the only reason he wanted to really try to get a more pure sound and resonance out of the mandolin is because he was performing. He was a performer, and he was such, they called him a musical genius back then repeatedly. And because he wanted to get that music out, he wanted to, like, project in the auditorium. You know, we didn't have the AP systems that we have today. We didn't have the amps. You know, those were not resources. So he had to build an instrument that would project sound. So that's really what he did.
Yeah.
So he did that with the mandolin, and he made multiple violins. He made, you know, guitars. He made a number of instruments.
He made a lot of interesting, unusual type of instruments. But I just wanted to mention real quick, we had on the show a friend of mine, Jim LaDiana, who was talking about the studio scene before and big band scene before the Wrecking Crew. And a lot of those guys worked with Gibson. Now, Gibson had already passed away, but developing primarily, I would think, the L5, but a lot of the archtop guitar. And then, I mean, the innovations that Gibson had, the Charlie Christian pickup, which changed the guitar from being a rhythm instrument to a melody instrument, which that was a major change in terms of big band and jazz. And eventually later on, the humbucker, the list goes on. I mean, everything, that major innovation that we see in our guitars today, was a lot of it was from Gibson directly, from what he was doing.
Well, he actually stopped. He stopped in Kalamazoo when he was. He moved back to New York in 1909, and when he did that, what he, and I really think when he passed on in 1918, he left a spirit, and that spirit is in Kalamazoo, undoubtedly at 225 Parsons Street. His spirit continued on in those builders in Kalamazoo at 225 Parsons Street. I like to say that you could take the man out of Kalamazoo, but you couldn't take the Kalamazoo out of the man.
Right.
And you can see, as you say, you know, person after person, and there's almost like a handshake of people who knew Orville, and then this person knew that person, and they, you know, it really continues on. So there's really a genealogy of people who were inspired and continue to be inspired by Orville. And they don't, you know, a lot of people don't even know it. They just know that there is something that kind of like overtakes them with the guitar. And that, I think, traces back. I mean, we were at 225 Parsons Street for the 100th anniversary of the opening of the building in 1917. So we were there last year a couple of times. And to talk to the people that are there today, the luthiers that are there today, building and crafting, handcrafting, you talk to them and they understand it. You know, they get it. They know that they have a calling, and that spirit. So Orville may have died 1918. He may have moved out of Kalamazoo in 1909, but he left a legacy there that continued.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when he moved, a friend of his, Ted McHugh, not to be confused with Ted McCarty, but Ted McHugh was a friend of his that he had gotten involved in the music, singing, because Ted McHugh had a great voice. And for three decades, he was associated with 225 Parsons Street,
mm-hmm.
and with Gibson, and then, you know, so he really was so important in conveying the spirit of Orville, and he had those direct conversations. Lloyd Lohr is someone who, when you read the personalities of Lloyd Lohr, it's almost like reading the personality of Orville Gibson. So then, you know, there is these really direct connections, you know, one person to, you know, to another, and they talk, and you know, you can't help but be inspired.
Well, it makes sense what you were talking about him playing. He really liked banjo and mandolin because the mandolins are obviously highly valued, but the master tone banjo is mm-hmm. like the holy grail of banjos. And I remember, you know, those were like, you know, those things sounded so great. That shell, the whole design. So it makes sense. So, but the what was his at the time when he started to build, when he set up the plant, and when he started actually building guitars or instruments? What was the, and maybe this is a question for Richard, what was the scene? What was going on at the time in terms of guitars, in terms of, well, mandolins, all the instruments? What was around that compelled him to set up his own company and build his own instruments?
Well, mandolins were, and the mandolin family was the main entrance of Orville Gibson. He first started out building violins. And he had a studio as early as 1887 in Kalamazoo, Michigan. Nobody's ever found one of his violins, to my knowledge. His early instruments started appearing in 1895, and then some of those still survive. He, by then, was applying for a patent. And the patent was to a revolution in mandolins, which were primarily known as potato bug or bowback mandolins at the time. Mm-hmm. And his mandolin was constructed like a violin, an arched top, an arched back. But there were, he went way beyond that with his patent. His patent was filed in May of 1895 and granted in February 1st of 1898. And his guitars called for, and mandolins, well, mandolin was the popular instrument, and guitar was almost an afterthought for Orville. And the surviving instruments that he built, there's maybe six or seven guitars and probably about 30 plus mandolin family instruments. And then there are harp guitars. There are eight or nine that are known of that he built before the Gibson Company started, but very few survived. Anyway, what was unique about Orville's instruments was they were totally hollow on the inside. They did not have what we know of as an archtop bridge these days. It was an actual pinned bridge on the guitars. And the sides were carved rather than bent out of wood and continued halfway up the neck. The necks were hollow. The inside of the guitar had no braces, no neck blocks, and no end pin blocks. And because Orville thought that this would interfere with the resonance of the instrument.
I would like to just kind of back up just a little bit with one of the reasons for telling the story about Orville, and I'm so appreciative to have Edwin and Trevor be a part of it, and really they've inspired me. But one of the things that the research in the 4 years I've been doing it, I have approached it kind of like a cold case. Didn't know anything, just came in. And we're going to correct a few things in history with Orville. One of the things I really would like to correct that, and I won't go into everything tonight, but just one statement is in 1891, there is a written account in August 15th, and I'll just read it. Orville Gibson has just completed a fine spruce guitar, and the circular opening is surrounded with inlays of mother of pearl of exquisite workmanship. The head of the guitar is a harp design. It has taken his spare moments for 8 months to do the work of fine-toned instrument. And so that is something that was published back then. That is a publication contemporaneous to his time. So mm-hmm. that wasn't somebody going back. So all of the history books, you read all of the history books, and they date him to becoming, opened up a new shop, and that's when he did. But he sold his first commercial guitar in 1891. So he was working, you know, out of somewhere. He just hadn't opened his shop. As Richard says, it was 18, you know, he opens up his shop 1894, he gets his, you know, he applies for his patent. And by this time, he has sold quite a number of instruments. And so he was feeling pretty confident at that point.
Well, what was out there? I know we know Martin had been around for a while, Martin guitars, but what other luthiers were there in guitars and mandolins? And was Epiphone wasn't around at that point, right?
No, Washburn was there, Bowman, a company called Howe and Orne, and I'm sure Richard may know others that Orville would have been in competition with, because these are companies that he was willing to go and put his instruments on display with at fairs and things.
Right.
So I know those were his competitors.
Well, nobody was building archtop guitars.
Right.
And Orville started building guitars. Everybody was building flat top guitars, mm-hmm. Or flat tops with a slight arch in them. But the archtop guitar was Orville's invention. And the mandolin, as we know it today, the A-style and F-style mandolin were his inventions. And he revolutionized luthiery in these particular instruments during his life. Harp guitars were very popular at that time, and Orville was also building harp guitars. But they were generally flat-top instruments, like Martin guitars were flat-top guitars, or Washburn guitars were flat-top guitars. Orville's were arch-top. Orville's had no braces. Everybody else used bracing to keep things together. The arch was the strength of the instrument for Orville.
Yeah, and you had mentioned me when we had talked on the phone, and it's interesting, and this is important to realize too. We were talking a little bit at the time of Martin. At that time, Martins were using gut string. There was no nylon, I don't think, at that time. It was gut string. Whereas Orville, his guitars were originally designed for steel string, correct?
That is correct. As far as I know, his mandolins and guitars and harp guitars, well, the harp guitars use some gut strings and a combination of steel strings on the guitar neck. But his guitars were steel string guitars.
Mm-hmm.
And his mandolins were steel string instruments as well. And most of the Italian or the bowlback mandolins were using steel strings as well.
Mm-hmm.
So steel strings had been around for a while. Just Martin, who was the premier builder at the time, if you wanted steel strings, it was a custom order. And I'm not quite sure they really built very many before 1900 that were custom ordered with mm-hmm. steel strings. It wasn't until 1927 that Martin was building steel string guitars, and gut strings now became the custom order.
Mm-hmm. So the when did Martin start using steel string?
I think in the early 1900s, but only if you custom ordered with steel strings, because they had to put a heavier bracing system into the guitars to accommodate the increased tension.
So the Gibson guitars, or Orville's guitars, with the steel string would be dynamically superior. They'd be much louder. And
yes,
in performing live, that's a big difference, because remember, there, like you said, there were no PA systems, there were no pickups at that time. That would be a very important thing. And then if you were talking about the type of shows that he played in, variety shows and stuff, where they had a pit band, that would be an important, that would cut through. Because that's one of the things that I noticed about the Art Shop, and we discussed this on the other show with Jim LaDiana, was how the guitar, the archtop originally in big band, functioned as the rhythm caper, not the drums. The drums did the accents and stuff, but that guy was the rhythm guitar was the foundation of the band. And those guitars, they didn't use pickups in those original big band things you hear from the 30s and stuff. That's all acoustic, and those things cut. And even these guitars, we have some of the heritage ones in here. They're pretty loud with, you know, there's a pickup on them, but I'll let Greg just play it right now. You'll hear it. That's without a pickup. That's just cutting through. And you can hear it's a rich sound. It's full. Now, we're just using our vocal mics here, and he's playing about, you know, he's getting a lot of the room sound in here too, but that guitar cuts, and it's a pretty full-bodied sound. So for you know, for big band or for any type of thing, it's a pretty powerful guitar without the pickup. You know, we're so used to having pickups now, it's amazing how that developed.
The one thing I would add to that is that in the 1920s and in the teens, there were a lot of hybrid instruments being developed because the guitar was not loud enough.
Mm-hmm.
So you had mandolin banjos, you had guitar banjos, you had a lot of banjo family instruments because the banjo pot added a lot of volume that could be heard over the horns and the other instruments. As far as Orville was concerned, he was always playing in bands, and they were mostly mandolin orchestras.
Mm-hmm.
Mandolin orchestra would be a mandolin, a mandola, which was comparable to a viola, a mandocello, which was comparable to the violoncello, and later a mandolin bass, which are very rare. The guitar was an accompaniment instrument to a mandolin orchestra, and the archtop guitar with the steel strings was needed to stay up in the at a comparable volume.
Right, right. But the like, for example, I have an 8-string banjo mandolin. Banjolin, I guess, is what they call it. Did Orville make hybrid instruments like that? Did he make a banjolin or anything?
He's not known for making any banjos. In fact, the Gibson Company didn't even build a banjo until 1918.
Yeah,
I couldn't find any record whatsoever where he ever made a banjo, but he was a huge fan of the banjo. And
well, it's amazing how the company just went on to develop a legendary banjo.
Well, in 1902, that's when he sold the rights, the licensing rights to his patent to a group of investors in Kalamazoo. There were 5 investors, and they were made up of a group, 3 attorneys, and one person was a musician, and then they had a person who was really a great marketing genius. And they took Orville, and Orville was a smart man. He was chronically ill through much of his life. There were times where he had bouts, but he knew he could not supply the demand of his guitars. He had an order for 500 mandolins, and this was out of a Boston firm, and they asked, well, how long would it take you, and how much would it cost? Well, he says, well, it'll cost $100 a mandolin, and it'll take 500 years. Well, he was one man, so he knew. So, you know, he had offers. He had an offer to buy his patent for, one fellow offered him $8,000 to buy it, and he wouldn't do it. He said, no, it's worth $10,000. He had another offer, and he finally took about the third serious offer. And that was with the investors in Kalamazoo, because I think that's where he could have the most control. And then with the company, then he became the superintendent. He did not, he owned stock initially in the corporation, I guess. But then he gave up his stock. But he was a superintendent, and so he really mentored people. So when we talk about, you know, you talk about the innovations, well, really, again, it's that spirit. He, you know, he taught, they taught, and then it continued on. But the marketing genius of Lewis Williams just cannot be overlooked. He really, those mandolin clubs, those early mandolin clubs, they got instruments in the hands of clubs and really big performers of the day. And really, the name Orville already had he was an international name, because just in 1900, just after his patent, he had received the Parisian Inventors Award, and he received a gold medal. And so he went international, and he was really well recognized. So he set the mark of how his company was going to be marketed, and he didn't have the wherewithal. I mean, it's impossible to be the luthier, to be the businessman, to be the marketing person. Yeah. He couldn't do all of that. So he thought this group would be able to do it. And that really what was accomplished, you know, like just like anything, there's always ups and downs. You know, they didn't always see eye to eye, but they carried on what he started.
So when he passed, this group is became the...
And they owned the, and that group, even though they were not entirely intact at that point because of deaths and things, but one of the original of that group, he owned the company until 1944. And then 1944, that's when Gibson Corporation sold to Chicago Music. And so then, you know, it went on. And so it's always been in... it's always been in hands in one form or another, if not from the owners, then from the builders inside. And most of the 99% of the time, it's the builders inside. And then they get people who really know that there is something unique about these instruments. And so, you know, they promote it on different levels. But really, that's how it grew. It took a combination of craftsmanship and business.
So the people that are in Heritage now, they came on board probably in the 40s, right?
50s, or about 50s.
So it was pretty close to that changeover. Mm-hmm. So the tradition was there.
Yes.
That's the key, is that it's been passed down.
Yes.
And the building techniques that Heritage is using is the original, is the way, you know, the way they build the guitars is the way they were built for years and years and years.
Yeah. Greg can speak.
Absolutely. Sharon covered a lot of that information already. But, you know, without the genius of O.H. Gibson, the master luthier, progenitor, and forefather, with insight, foresight, and passion, there would be no 225 Parsons Street. And, of course, there'd be no Heritage at Kalamazoo. Orville's the reason. Heritage can proudly boast we are the guitar manufacturer with pedigree and provenance like no other. And that's because we're carrying on that spirit of Orville that he left behind, which was a quality instrument with tone, timbre, and a musical purpose.
Mm-hmm. I got a question for Richard on the mandolins. The first mandolins that he made were, they're all archtop, but were they the teardrop type, the A type? Or, because didn't he make some with scrolling, like the more articulate fives?
Yes, the first mandolins were the A style or the... pear-shaped mandolins, and the scroll mandolins known as the F-type were the late 1890s is the earliest that I know about. And it's just a fancier instrument, the Fs. And they did have a different sound as well than the As, but very close.
Well, did the scroll give more resonance? I'm just wondering if there was an actual acoustic principle on that, you know, if it actually affected it.
I think it increased the cubic volume of the sound chamber by a bit, which would translate to additional volume. But they also had a different tone than the A mandolins did. And they were all oval hole instruments at the time, nothing with today we recognize the F holes like a violin has on the top of the mandolins. Mm-hmm. That was something that was developed after Orville Gibson had passed away.
Oh, okay.
And even as early as 1904, 1905, the Gibson Company started altering Orville's design because it was too expensive to build the instruments the way Orville wanted them to be built. In other words, it was too expensive to carve the sides out of one piece of wood. That's throwing away, cutting out the whole inside of a board and then the outside of a board and have it go partially up to half the neck. It was just a lot of wood being wasted and very time consuming. Bending wood like every other manufacturer was doing at the time became the normal thing by sometime in, I believe, in late 1904. And it's rumored that Orville was pretty upset that Gibson was beginning to alter his designs.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he spent less and less time at the factory after that.
Were the mandolins made like the guitars, where they were spruce tops with maple backs and sides?
Or? They were spruce tops originally with walnut back and sides.
Oh, walnut. Okay.
Yes. And in the early Gibson catalogs, they were advertised as being maple back and sides, but they were primarily birch back and sides.
Oh, really? Birch. Oh, that's interesting.
With spruce tops.
Yeah, because all of that would affect the sound. Now, I know later, I forget the model. It was an artist model, archtop guitar that had the scroll. And I'm just curious if that resonated more.
But the stylo became the stylo with the scroll. Orville Gibson was very fixated on scrolls, and I believe that it was because of his interest in violins. And, I mean, that's where you always see the scroll. So
yeah.
I sent you a picture of a guitar with four scrolls carved into the bridge.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have the scroll mandolins, and then eventually you had a guitar with a scroll on it. And so he really liked the scrolls.
Yeah,
but I believe it all emanates from his love for violins.
Well, that type of design and stuff, if you look at the furniture at the turn of the century in the early, like my grandmother's furniture had little scrolls on the chair arms and stuff. It was really ornate and beautiful stuff. Well, but that's interesting that it was walnut and then also birch, because it definitely that would affect the sound, and it would... It's interesting because I always thought they were most of the guitars, at least in the catalog, the old Gibson catalogs, they mentioned it was usually maple, usually the guitars.
Yes, they did, but they weren't, except for maybe the top of the line instruments. Everything else was birch, which had an appearance similar to maple.
So when Orville was building, when he built a guitar, which I presume is the one you're holding in the picture that we'll be posting. So those guitars were always the oval hole. He never did an F-hole guitar, right? Like the L5?
No, never.
Okay.
You know, you talk about his influences. Well, really, I think where his greatest influences came were from his two brothers. Because one brother was a carpenter, the other was an upholsterer, and the family was very musical. So they, coming from an area in New York where there would have been a lot of lumber, in the area, and also his one brother also had a secondhand store, so it was like recycling, repurposing everything. And so Orville grew up with the constant building and carving, and if his brother's doing furniture and different things, he learned how to do that just because that was just a part of how he grew up. So that's, and
well, I'm sure his brother advised him on the woods.
Oh, absolutely.
So, you know.
Mm-hmm. Grand Rapids was just down the road from Kalamazoo. It was the furniture capital of the United States
during
that period.
Mm-hmm. Now, the guitar that you're holding in this picture that you sent me, this one that was actually built by Orville, can you tell us a little bit about it? What kind of wood? And talk a little bit about the sound of it.
Well, this is, the sound of it is somewhere between what we think of as an archtop guitar sound today and maybe a Dreadnought Martin with steel strings.
Mm-hmm.
It had a bridge like a flat top guitar. And in fact, where the bridge was mounted, the top was flat, but it was arched all the way to the rims of the guitar.
Mm-hmm.
So it was an early archtop guitar, and it wasn't soon after that Gibson changed to an adjustable bridge that was not glued to the top, and there were no more bridge pins used, and that was by late 1904.
Mm-hmm. What kind of wood is that? What's on there? What's the top and the sides and back?
The top is spruce. The sides and back are walnut.
Walnut.
They look like mahogany, but they are walnut.
Yeah, it's an interesting finish, at least from the picture. It's kind of a reddish hue to it, so... It's hard
and understand that walnut was native to the area.
Mm-hmm.
And spruce, even though the Gibson catalog advertised back then that their spruce was Norwegian spruce, I believe it was Adirondack spruce from the Appalachian.
And what kind of finish was that? Was that a nitrocellulose, or that didn't exist then?
Didn't exist. It was a varnish finish.
A varnish.
Finish.
And the same thing for the mandolins, right? It was all varnish?
All the early instruments. I don't believe Gibson was using varnish until about 1923, 1924. And Martin didn't start using lacquer until 1923 or 4. And Martin, about 1927.
Mm-hmm. When did Orville do any type of binding and like on the edge, or any binding on the fretboard like we see on some of the more fancy Gibsons, or was that later?
Yes, and I believe that his binding was bought from German makers. They were catalog items.
Oh, okay. Because certainly, I notice on this guitar that you're holding, the sound hole has inlay in it. I think it's
inlay.
Yeah.
He may have done, you know, he certainly did the inlay. Whether he fabricated the inlay or just bought it, you know, from a supply house, it remains to be seen. Even Gibson in the early years was doing the same thing. They were buying prefabricated inlay and binding strips and colorful wood marquetry to, you know, border the guitars. That was being made elsewhere. It was easier to buy it than to make it by hand.
And I notice also, too, the tuning keys are like banjo keys. Are those original? Or, I mean, did they have mechanical keys at that time?
Yes, they did. And Orville favored friction pegs. And most of his instruments came with Grover Champion pegs, which were the friction pegs of the period. Although occasionally he would use gear tuners. Why? I don't know. And it wasn't soon after that he joined Gibson that Gibson pretty much switched to gear tuners.
Okay, because the Grover Champion pegs are like, so that people know, they're like banjo ones. They go straight back. They're not to the tuning button is not on the side like a traditional guitar that you see now. It's straight back.
It wasn't a functional choice. I think it was an aesthetic choice on his part.
Right. And just to get an idea of what was going on, what was Martin using at that time? Were they using the same type of keys, or did they... I know classical guitars, some of them had the original wood thing, like a violin, where you just... It stayed in place by friction.
Martin was using both, and they were using both in the early... Well, not the early 1840s, 1850s. Martin was already using gear tuners. But they also offered guitars with friction pegs, and a lot of them were made out of ivory.
Right. Okay. Oh, ivory pegs. Wow.
Yes, and the Martin guitars were bound in elephant ivory as well.
Oh, okay. But they weren't using ebony pegs like the classicals, were they? Because I thought that most of the traditional... Same thing for violin. They were ebony, if I'm correct.
They probably did on their lower-priced guitars, yes.
But that's interesting. It's interesting that they had geared tuners, because that would make a difference, too. Plus... with the steel string and the geared tuners, the accuracy of the tuning, and even with the bridge, the pin bridge that you have on your guitar, that's a pretty, that would be loud, you know, responsive, and it would cut through really well but stay in tune. So,
well, the early Gibson guitars and mandolins were that had friction pegs were very difficult to tune.
Right. I would think so, yeah. I'm surprised that a lot of violin players don't go to gear tunings, to be honest with you. But, no, that's very interesting. So what so he primarily made these. What was the next big innovation? What else did he develop, so we get an idea of how the genius of him? What else did he develop? I mean, the arch top itself is amazing. But
Gibson was promoting harp guitars.
Okay.
Was also an instrument that Orville was building before the Gibson Company existed.
Mm-hmm.
And as late as their 1921 catalog, they felt the guitar was going to become obsolete and be replaced by the harp guitar.
Mm-hmm.
And if you read their advertising, which is quite has quite a flourish to it, they were putting down the guitar even at that period in time. And Gibson still was not building flat-top guitars.
Right. But who actually, where did the harp guitar come from?
That was their harp guitars were made in Europe in the late 1800s. There was a gentleman named Knutson out of Washington State who was building harp guitars and who eventually licensed his design to the Larson brothers in Chicago, who were building the Dyer harp guitars. They were flat-top instruments.
Oh, okay.
And they were quite lovely and beautiful sounding. The Gibson harp guitar was an archtop, unlike anybody else's harp guitar.
Oh, okay. Because a friend of mine, his grandmother has a Knutson. It's a Knutson that I think was made here in Los Angeles. So
Knutson eventually moved to Los Angeles and also started building Hawaiian guitars and harp mandolins and all kinds of hybrid instruments, and none of his instruments were the same.
Were the harp guitars used for the mandolin orchestras, or was it more of just a straight guitar? Did they use those?
Occasionally used in mandolin orchestras. Yes, they were.
Oh, okay.
There was also a gentleman, Joseph Bastolfi, who had just a little Italian trio, and he played a harp guitar. And the reviews that you read back in the day, he had a violinist, and I don't remember if it was mandocello or whatever, but anyway, another. It was just a string trio, and he had a harp guitar, and they would, the newspaper articles would, the reviews would write up how there was this amazing guitar, this, you know, huge guitar, and the sound of it and the strings. And it was when Bastolfi was playing it, he was playing before audiences that maybe hadn't seen one before, but he played it, and he really was well known back at the time. And he had Orville himself had made Bastolfi for sure one, but I believe two, because he had lost one in the fire.
I believe it was two also, and they both burnt in a fire in Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. And Orville made him some additional ones in around 1905.
No, it's interesting, because with like a trio or a small group like that, he would function as the bass player too, instead of an upright or something like that. And I've had several people on that use them, so there's a resurgence for them. They're quite popular. So, and there's a few luthiers now making them based on the earlier designs. But it would seem, yeah, for a small ensemble, but in a mandolin orchestra where you have the mando bass or the mando cello, I was just curious if it would it work, or, you know, or it was maybe if they didn't have those, it would work with the mandolin orchestra. So it was always, even those harp guitars, the function was to support the mandolin orchestra, if I'm correct.
Yeah, it's over 100 years ago, but I'm sure there were solo harp guitar players. I just, you know, you're not going to find a recording of any. I haven't really followed the record or done the research on that. But you see them appearing in a lot of the mandolin orchestras and a lot of small bands, you know, 5-6-piece bands.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to encourage people. Right now, the NAM Museum, the Museum for Making Music in Carlsbad, has a beautiful harp guitar exhibit going on with different makers. And
do they have Gibson ones?
Yes, they do. And then they go into makers of today. So I would highly recommend anyone interested in a harp guitar, go and see that exhibit. Even if you're not, if you just like music or string instrument, it's an absolutely amazing exhibit.
No, it's interesting. I mean, we went in detail on how they're strung up in the tuning of the drone strings, and it's amazing. It's a whole thing in itself, but it's like, you know, it's amazing what those things sound like when you know what you're doing. Players I've had on, they just sound, it just sounds like more than one person.
I would encourage people to visit a website called harpguitars.com. And Greg Miner, who owns that website, has done more research than anybody on harp guitars. And in fact, some of the most beautiful harp guitars ever built by Gibson for the 1903 World's Fair are pictured there. And they're unbelievably ornate and beautiful. And I'm sure that even though they were built after the establishment of the Gibson factory, they were really Orville's work.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, we're getting close to the end. I want to make sure that we mention a bunch of different things. I wanted to really quick, if I know it's in the pre-production stages, but I wanted to mention a little bit about the what you're doing with the documentary, because I think that's important. And also, too, I just want everybody to know, this is part one. We're going to come back. Everybody's going to come back in August when it's closer to the actual date of Orville's passing. So we'll have, in August, we'll come back and continue. So this is going to, because we're already running out of time, and we're just scratching the surface on what's going, you know, what's happening. So I just wanted Sharon to mention a little bit of this, you know, what's in store, because hopefully we might be able to, if it's, you know, the next show, we might be able to announce when you can get it, because I think this is something everybody should have on video.
Well, actually, Trevor is the one who had an idea for putting Orville's story on film, and then he brought in Edwin, and all I am is the researcher.
Okay.
And a cheerleader.
And well, a great cheerleader she is, too, because you can hear her enthusiasm right now. She's telling you stories about Orville Gibson, and every time she starts speaking to me about it, there's another scene in the movie, or whatever movie we're going to make. But I play guitar, and it was inevitable our paths would cross at one point. So I went to a guitar show once, about a year and a half ago, I guess, and I met a gentleman who was writing a book about Gibson guitars. And I told him I make movies. I told him about the movie that I was making about the life story of Bill Monroe, the man who created bluegrass, and how far along I'd gotten on that. And he said, well, there's a woman here I know who wants to make a story about Orville Gibson, has a similar sort of storyline and so on. So he introduced me to Sharon, and I could see right away that she had the passion for the story and the desire to keep something like this going. And she started telling me about Orville Gibson, and she also jumped way ahead and said she envisaged a feature about it, and how she envisaged Johnny Depp playing the role of Orville. And I'm thinking to myself, this is great. Here's a woman who shoots for the moon. I like this positivity.
Actually, that's not that far-fetched, because Johnny Depp's a guitar player, and he's real into... He might just do it.
I just think,
you know, totally not out of the question. And the stars sometimes align. And I regard the fact that I met Sharon is like the aligning of the stars as well. You know, one little brick in a wall that might be built.
I just want to interject too about Trevor. Trevor's a 2-time Emmy nominee, and he worked on Lost, and he's worked on American Beauty and a bunch of other shows. He's no lightweight. Besides being a great guitar player, he's definitely knows his stuff as an editor, as a videographer, as a sound design person and sound editor and sound mixer. So he's done a lot of interesting stuff. So there's some big talent here. And also Edwin as a producer too has a pretty good has a big track record. So I just want to throw that out there, that there's some heavy people involved in this, which I think will be a good thing.
Well, Edwin fills in the gaps that I don't have. He's in marketing, fundraising, getting the early stages of the movie made. My passion is the production and post-production and putting it all together. So
you have to have a great story, and the passion that Sharon brought to this, there's so many great storylines here. We're still in early development, but one of the biggest problems with this is there's so many great storylines. Such a great heritage, if I can say that, through the whole life of Orville and the life of Gibson and into heritage guitars, that we're not going to... The biggest problem is going to be narrowing it down.
Right. Mm. Well, that's an interesting time, too, and we don't know that much. It's a fascinating time because there was a lot of stuff happening around the turn of that century, and, you know, it influenced a lot of the design and the look and... You know, which led into the eventually after he passed into the 20s and 30s, the whole Art Deco, the whole thing. I mean, he was doing stuff on the instruments that eventually would have in the woods and stuff like that. Now I told you we'd go by fast. We're out of time, so I want to get all the credits and everything done. I'm just going to go around the line. If you have a question, if you have any questions about Orville, if I'm correct, we can use info@DeLordoGuitar, is that a good one to email to?
That would be a good one.
Okay, and then also, too, for more information on Greg, www.gregdelordo.com, and then for Heritage Guitars, heritageguitar.com. Gary, real quick, bassexchange.com, and if you're in the area out here in Los Angeles, go see his store. There's so many guitars there. It's, I mean, every time Doug and I go there, we just may have a wish list and we're ready to buy. Also, too, Richard, do you have an email that people can ask questions and talk to you?
Yes. rgellis@uniongrovemusic.com.
Right. And then www.uniongrovemusic.com is his website. And if you're up by Aptos, California, check out his music store. And he's an official repair person for Gibson, Martin, Fender, and a bunch of other ones. So especially if you have an older instrument, he's the guy to talk to get it fixed correctly and to preserve it. So that's another thing. And then also, too, tell me if I'm wrong. I'm going to mention real quick, oldgibson.com, your friend Robert Corwin, earlygibson.com, earlymartin.com, vintagemartin.com, sites to learn about more about the history and some of the older instruments, if that's correct.
Fabulous, fabulous sites. Just you won't believe it when you see them.
Okay. And then for Edwin, www.djangoproductions.com. And Trevor, is there any web?
Yes. Pivotal 50. It's not a website, though, email. Pivotal50@earthlink.net.
Pivotal50@earthlink.net. Okay. I'm writing that down so I have it too.
Good.
So everybody, that there's the information. Check out some more of the stuff, and we'll post some pictures of some of the guitars that they brought in. And I want to thank Sharon and Greg for this is a great show and meeting all these people. And Gary back there in the corner, he's the one that started it all. He's the one that connected me with you guys.
Absolutely.
So we're going to have another show, and I'll announce shortly the date of it. But we'll have a part two of this, and hopefully everybody will be able to come back and continue on and talk more about the innovations. I want to get into some of the innovations, even though after Orville's death, but there's so many things that are important that the Gibson Guitar Company came out with that's so vital to what we're playing today. I mean, it's pretty fascinating what they did with the arch top guitar and eventually with the pickup. I mean, they changed the whole face of guitar playing in big band and studio work. All of it. It's mind-boggling, and it's really significant how much the impact that it had on music in general, popular music. So, anyway.
I would just like to mention one thing just for the record. This is a totally independent project. I have my history, not a website, but just something I've been doing for over 30 years, and it's to preserve and remember is what I use. And this is a To Preserve and Remember project, and that's how Orville got into it. So we're not sponsored or anything from Heritage Guitar or Gibson Brands. It's totally, totally independent. So I just wanted the audience to know that, you know.
And one other thing, Orville had no children, but I believe he did in Sharon.
There's the Orville gene
right.
Somewhere in there.
Working it.
So, okay, well, listen, everybody, thank you so much. It's been really great to have everybody here. And we will be back with everybody in August. There's more to the story, and we'll have more information as we go. Everybody have a great night. It's great to have you guys listening to the show, and we will see you next week.